riding a wave of popular support, as leaders so often do in times of war. The Austrian government was unseated and replaced by a new leadership friendly to Germany, and German corporations began to take over Austrian resources. In a speech responding to critics of the invasion, Hitler said, "Certain foreign newspapers have said that we fell on Austria with brutal methods. I can only say, even in death, they cannot stop lying. I have in the course of my political struggle won much love from my people. But when I crossed the former frontier into Austria, there met me such a stream of love as I have never experienced. Not as tyrants have we come, but as liberators." To deal with those who dissented from his policies, at the advice of his politically savvy advisers, he and his handmaidens in the press began a campaign to equate him and his policies with patriotism and the nation itself. National unity was essential, they said, to ensure that the terrorists or their sponsors didn't think they'd succeeded in splitting the nation or weakening its will. In times of war, they said, there could only be one people, one nation, and one commander in chief, ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer. And so his advocates in the media began a nationwide campaign charging that critics of his policies were attacking the nation itself. Those questioning him were labeled anti-German or not good Germans, and it was suggested that they were aiding the enemies of the state by failing in the patriotic necessity of supporting the nation's valiant men in uniform. It was one of his most effective ways to stifle dissent and pit wage-earning people, from whom most of the army came, against the intellectuals and liberals who were critical of his policies. Nonetheless, once the small war annexation of Austria was successfully and quickly completed and peace returned, voices of opposition were again raised in the homeland. The almost daily release of news bulletins about the dangers of terrorist communist cells wasn't enough to rouse the populace and totally suppress dissent. A full-out war was necessary to divert public attention from the growing rumbles within the country about disappearing dissidents, violence against liberals, Jews, and union leaders, and the epidemic of crony capitalism that was producing empires of wealth in the corporate sector but threatening the middle class's way of life. A year later to the week, Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia. The nation was now fully at war, and all internal dissent was suppressed in the name of national security. It was the end of Germany's first experiment with democracy. As we conclude this review of history, there are a few milestones worth remembering. February 27, 2003 was the 70th anniversary of the Dutch terrorist Marinus van der Lubbe's successful bombing of the German Parliament Reichstag building, the terrorist act that catapulted Hitler to legitimacy and reshaped the German constitution. By the time of his successful and brief action to seize Austria, in which almost no German blood was shed, Hitler was the most beloved and popular leader in the history of his nation. Hailed around the world, he was later Time magazine's Man of the Year. Most Americans remember his office for the security of the homeland, known as the Reichssicher Hauptamt and its Schutzstaffel, simply by its most famous agency's initials, the SS. We also remember that the Germans developed a new form of highly violent warfare they named Lightning War or Blitzkrieg, which, while generating devastating civilian losses, also produced a highly desirable shock and awe among the nation's leadership, according to the authors of the 1996 book Shock and Awe, published by the National Defense University Press. Reflecting on that time, the American Heritage Dictionary, Houghton Mifflin Company, 1983, left us this definition of the form of government the German democracy had become through Hitler's close alliance with the largest German corporations and his policy of using war as a tool to keep power. Fascism. Noun. A system of government that exercises a dictatorship of the extreme right, typically through the merging of state and business leadership together with belligerent nationalism. Today, as we face financial and political crisis, it's useful to remember that the ravages of the Great Depression hit Germany and the United States alike. Through the 1930s, however, Hitler and Roosevelt chose very different courses to bring their nations back to power and prosperity. Germany's response was to use government to empower corporations and reward the society's richest individuals, privatize much of the commons, stifle dissent, strip people of constitutional rights, and create an illusion of prosperity through continual and ever-expanding war. America passed minimum wage laws to raise the middle class and forced antitrust laws to diminish the power of corporations, increased taxes on corporations and the wealthiest individuals, created Social Security, and became the employer of last resort through programs to build national infrastructure, promote the arts, and replant forests. To the extent that our Constitution is still intact, the choice is, again, ours. And I was reading an article called When Democracy Fails by Tom Hartman. Hartman is an author of over a dozen books, including Unequal Protection and The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. He lived and worked in Germany during the 1980s. For more information on Hartman, you can visit his website at www.tomhartmann.com. That's TOMHARTMANN.com. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. If they haven't heeded your calls, letters, or protests, what else can you do? For those interested in a serious step, there is the withholding of funds from the government through war tax resistance. The National War Tax Resistance Committee, NUTRIC, is based in Ithaca. Next, a workshop on war tax resistance with Sasha Vodnik, which was given last January at the National Conference on Organized Resistance.
Well, let's just start out with the definition. So we've been throwing around this term war tax resistance. So you're talking in general about refusing to pay taxes that fund the military. And that's generally what we're talking about. I have personally a little bit different take on it. I think partially coming from an anarchist perspective, partially coming from anti-oppression work. What is war? I think that when we think of war, we generally think of, you know, people with guns, people with bombs, you know, causing physical injury, countries, nation states fighting. And I think it's also important to look at things like oppression and exploitation, like imperialism. You know, even things like systemic violence, the racism that pervades our country and our world. There's a group that I like to quote on this that came out right after the 9/11 events. It's a group called Racial Justice 911. And their understanding, it was a group led and based in people of color communities. They say they understand that wartime refers not only to the present U.S. military engagements, but it's also a wide range of international acts of aggression, economic sanctions, debt, and environmental destruction. And it also refers for them to the low-intensity warfare against people of color communities in the United States, particularly against immigrants, the poor, youth, and women, and increased military spending at the expense of domestic human need, health care, welfare, education, and housing. This group, NUTRIC, has a kind of succinct statement that they publish in each of their newsletters. NUTRIC sees poverty, racism, sexism, homophobia, economic exploitation, environmental destruction, and militarization of law enforcement as integrally linked with the militarism that we abhor. Through the redirection of our tax dollars, NUTRIC members contribute directly to the struggle for peace and justice for all. So it seems to me that the way that war is used in the media, the way it's used by the government, in my analysis, it's kind of a ruling class way of using the word and kind of perverting the word. It involves these outward tangible acts of violence that are committed by one state against another state. They're broadening that out now that we have, you know, stateless people actually committing these acts. I think that folks that, you know, have control of the government, have control of media, you know, they use our resources, our tax dollars, and our hard work to commit violence and oppression daily against many groups of people. Non-citizens, women, people of color, disabled people, queers, poor and working class folks. And I think that's violence and oppression that's built into the very structure of our society. through capitalism. Again, you're getting a little bit of the Sasha analysis and not like any sort of, you know, war tax resistance commonality here. So I think the structural violence is a form of war by people with money and power against everyone else as a way of holding on to power and thereby holding on to wealth. And so for me, it's just important to add in that analysis because I think, again, the movement got started looking at specific, you know, fighting wars and shooting at outward manifestations. But I think that, you know, I think having a deeper analysis and seeing all the different manifestations of that is really important in seeing what the end point of our work is as war tax resistance. So I wanted to go into the history a little bit, just give an overview. What examples do people know of specific instances in history where there's been war tax resistance? Henry David Thoreau, who was an American author from the 1800s, refused to pay taxes and spent a night in jail and wrote, he got bailed out against his will, and somebody else paid his tax for him, and he was pissed. And he ended up writing this essay that we've all probably read in high school on the duty of civil disobedience. What other instances do people know of war tax resistance?
Vietnam.
There was massive resistance. It's kind of, I think, in the war tax resistance community and movement, it's thought of as one of the kind of the high points in this country. From like 1964 to 75, when the U.S. was involved in Vietnam and the whole Southeast Asia area, at the peak, there were up to about 20,000 people who were resisting paying part or all of their income taxes. There were additional estimates range between 200,000 and 500,000 people who resisted paying the tax on their phone bills. We'll talk about that later in the tactics session, but that basically was a way to kind of put a bunch of little monkey wrenches in the works and really kind of gum things up. So yeah, the Vietnam era was a high point in the U.S. Other examples people know of? Stuff from other countries maybe? What about Gandhi? Anybody know about Gandhi and war tax resistance or tax resistance? Everybody heard of the March to the Sea? Yeah, who can tell something about that? Maybe somebody who hasn't spoken?
Britain had a tax on salt, so Gandhi, in refusing that, went to the sea and made his own salt. They were supposed to buy the salt from Britain and then hence pay the tax.
So that was a really ludicrous one where the British were trying to charge a tax on all salt. And of course, people in India at that point knew how to make salt, knew how to kind of distill it from the sea or what have you. And so the British were trying to make that illegal and charge a tax. And so as part of his program of eventual independence from Britain, he led a march of all these people to the sea to openly defy Britain and make their own salt. And I think that brings up one important aspect of war tax resistance, which is this question of being open about it or not. And in that case, you know, he was telling the papers, he was calling everybody and saying, we're going to march to the sea and make our own salt and defy the tax. The earliest known collective refusal of war taxes was reported in Egypt in the 2nd century of the Common Era, or after Christ. So, you know, like 1,800 years ago. And American Indians in 1637, the Algonquin tribe opposed taxation by the Dutch. Dutch were trying to tax these Indians to help improve a local fort, and they resisted that. Also, you know, today and about 10 years ago in the Intifadas over in occupied Palestine, there's a specific place that I know of. I mean, it's been used in general, but there's one town called Beit Sahur. They use it as a tactic to separate the Palestinians from the Israeli economy and administration, kind of the same thing as the colonists in Boston Tea Party and all that. They issued a statement which included, they said, we will not finance the bullets that kill our children, the growing number of prisons, the expenses of the occupying army. We want no more than what you have, freedom and our own representatives to pay taxes to. There's examples throughout history, throughout the world, and we've touched on the big ones. In my view, one of our failings or one of our weak points as the war tax resistance movement in the U.S. is that we focus a lot on the United States. And I think that's true of all movements in the United States. But I just think it's important that war tax resistance has been really an integral part of struggle against colonialism in particular around the world. I think that by acknowledging that and by learning about that, we're able to plug into this really strong history of resistance and that we have all of these forebears basically to draw on. And for me, that gives me a lot of strength, especially because war tax resistance can be really trying and really scary sometimes. So let's go on to the actual nuts and bolts stuff, the concrete ways that you resist paying taxes for war, and the risks and the potential consequences of not paying those taxes. I mean, I think to start off with, I'll just say, you know, today in the U.S., men are required to register for selective service. You can register as a conscientious objector and get out of serving if you were ever drafted. but there isn't a legal way to avoid having your money conscripted, basically. There's no legal way to register your opposition to paying for war. So I think it's just important to point out as a starting point that war tax resistance is civil disobedience. There is a plan floating in Congress right now called the Peace Tax Fund. You know, there's this idea that as an individual you could stipulate that none of your money go to the military. And, you know, there's pros and cons to that thing, but right now, you know, it's nowhere near passing anyway, so it's a moot point for the moment. I found on the web the other day, there's actually a Washington, D.C. war tax resistance group, and on their website they said, war tax resistance is civil disobedience. People do it because they feel so strongly that they are willing to risk their assets and even their freedom. It is wise to understand the possible consequences of this form of direct action for peace before beginning it. So let's start out with just, again, a little brainstorm. What are some ways that people have heard about or have practiced resisting war taxes? Specific ways that you go about doing that.
Simplified living.
Excellent. Simple living. Any other ways people are familiar with?
Putting like half of your taxes and then putting the other half into like a charity or a peace tax fund.
I don't know. My bottom line is that I'm part of the society and I would gladly pay taxes and kind of, you know, put in according to my need if I felt like I could do that in good conscience. And so that's what I'm working toward.
You cannot pay
your
tax on your phone, the federal tax.
Phone tax, yeah, very good. Good talk. Work as an independent contractor. And there's also, some people do what's called symbolic resistance. Who said simple living? Can you explain like how you resist taxes with simple living?
Just living under the tax line, like under $6,000.
So there's a threshold, a very, very, very low threshold, especially compared to every other country in the world, below which you don't have to pay tax. And I think right now it's actually like $8,000 at this point. So if you make under $8,000 a year, if you make $8,000 declared dollars a year or less, then you can fill out a tax form and say, I don't owe you any money. Sometimes you can even fill out a tax form and say, you owe me money. Because sometimes they do. There's the earned income tax credit and whatever. So simple living. You know, if you're not buying as much, if you walk instead of or a bicycle instead of owning a car. You know, all these little things. If you're working at paring down your life, it can have the side effect of actually eliminating your complicity in war and war taxes. I'll just say maybe I'll just kind of use myself as a case study, and if it gets boring, just let me know. But. I know a lot of people who do simple living, and I think there's the great argument for it. One argument that I've heard against it is that you're basically letting the government dictate your standard of living and your lifestyle. All of these things, you know, on any one of these tactics, it's all just a question of, you know, figuring out what works for you, and everybody's got their own style of resisting.
Does that mean you get one of those tax-exempt cards, so if you go into stores, you wouldn't pay taxes on...
No, that would be sales tax.
Okay.
That's a different thing. This is just when you fill out your income tax return at the end of the year or in April. Okay, so simple living. Paying only part of your income taxes. That was you.
That's like, well, people say that, you know, 50% of your money goes towards military, so some people will say... Okay, well, I'll pay 50% of what I owe you then, and then I'll take that other 50%, and some people put it in, like, peace tax funds, or I know, like, people will give it to charities and write a note with their W-2 and say, like, I put the other money into, you know, this charity that I agree with so that it's not going towards war.
Right, right. So, yeah, so when you fill out your tax form in April and send it in, people work it so that they owe some money and then they just refuse to pay that money. And you can do, I mean, I guess what we didn't list up here is not paying your income tax. You can send in the form and just say, you know, I'm not paying you a cent. But yeah, there's one line of thinking, which is I don't want to pay the war part, so I'm going to pay the other part. There's other folks who don't pay anything. All different ways and permutations to do that.
But that doesn't work if they're already taking the money out beforehand.
Yeah, and that actually, we get to the exemptions. When you first start a job, you fill out the W-2 form and it says how many exemptions you claim. And so there's these things you can do, basically. As I understand it these days, if you report 10 or more exemptions on that form, the employer has to send it to the IRS and just say, just so you know, this person's saying they have 10 kids or whatever. But if you say 9 or less, and so a lot of people will say 9 exemptions, and then that basically allows you to earn more money with each week without having taxes taken out. And which, well, all that does is really put the ball back in your court. Instead of having the money taken out, you've got the money, and then you get to make the decision of whether or not to send it in. You know, and again, that's you're filing. There's potential penalties for doing that. There's potential penalties for all this stuff. Fill out the W-2 form. You're allowed to put in a number, and you don't have to justify that number. It's actually, in some cases, you put in a number that's different than reality because that's the way your taxes are supposed to work. Like, the government's okay with that. But yeah, when you get around to filling out your tax form, you're right, when you get into actually filling out, you know, this child and this blind parent or whatever. Yeah. And I don't know all the technicalities of that. Almost nobody goes to jail for tax resistance. Not these days, anyway. Probably in that book it says the last time somebody went to jail, but it's been like a decade or two, and it's like few and far between. Basically, all the government wants is stuff. If it's not going to be able to get the stuff, what's it going to do? The real penalty is...
It can't be that easy, though. They're going to come after you for the money eventually, right?
The real penalty is that, I mean, they'll charge you a penalty. You know, like, okay, so you're like, April comes along, and I'm not filing an income tax return. So I'm going to get a penalty for not filing on time. And then they're going to start accruing interest for starting from that date, because I was supposed to have sent them a certain amount of money ad infinitum. You know, I didn't file starting in 1994, and they've been clocking interest ever since then. You know, there's been a penalty for every quarter I didn't file estimated taxes. And, you know, so all these things are just kind of adding up, and, you know.
And you just want to repay it, and they don't come after you and like call you and be like, you know, you got a couple $1,000 here you owe us.
I mean, this is for me, this is where it gets kind of tricky, because, I mean, the IRS is not well-liked by anybody, including Congress. So the IRS is not well-funded. The IRS has, as I understand it, either 7 or 9 different computer systems that can't communicate with each other. And so they can look up some information about you here, and then they have to walk over here and look up that information and try and like make sure it's the same person. And you know, they had to keep doing these shifting things where they knocked off a whole bunch of people who were doing audits at one point because they didn't have money for it anymore, and then there was all the squawking because they weren't doing audits anymore. So the IRS at this point is kind of this gumshoe detective sort of thing, just, you know, like tripping over their own feet. I mean, I can tell you, I've been resisting since 1994, and I've gotten exactly one letter in the mail during all that time, and it said, we're not sure we have the correct address on file for you. Could you fill out this form and let us know? And, you know, like I said, I mean, I guess for me, ideally, just personally, you know, I'd like it if the IRS functioned well, and if they could just, like, nab me a month later and just say, hey, man, you didn't pay your taxes, and then just, like, you know, there's nothing, like, you know, I mean, it's nice to be able to resist. But like I said, I also feel like I'd like to be part of the society and contributing. And so I guess it's not a long-term dream of mine that the IRS doesn't function well. But right now it's kind of convenient. Yeah.
I was just wondering, like, if you're in a job, you've already filled out your W-2 form, could you go back to your boss and say, can I change my number of exemptions on that? And will that raise any red flags with the...
As far as the last I knew, your W-2 is between you and the government. Your employer isn't even really supposed to look at it. They're not supposed to ask you about it at all. It's none of their business. And I don't know if that's changed in the last couple of years, but as far as I know, that's the case. So you should be able to just go in there and say, I need to change my W-2. You don't owe them any explanation. They shouldn't ask you any questions. And if they do, you can just tell them that it's not, you know, it's none of their business, basically.
I was wondering if you would run across, Sasha, any situations where... people paying a percentage of their tax, and what they do with the other percentage is they put it into, you know, like some kind of escrow or some kind of fund or some kind of legal defense that gathers interest, so that when the IRS finally does catch up to them, sort of like a mutual aid society, there will be money there that will pay the penalty for them, and so they can do it with as little risk as possible.
Yeah. There is this amazing group in Indiana called the War Tax Resisters Penalty Fund. It's run by a Mennonite church or a Fellowship of Reconciliation group, something like that. But basically, they have a list of people. So say tomorrow I go home and I find a letter waiting for me from the IRS, and they're saying, okay, you owe us from 1994, you know, $3,200 in taxes, plus you owe us $10,000 in penalties for all this stuff. And so say finally, you know, they've got my back against the wall. I have three kids. I just bought a house because I need to have a place for my kids to live. And I'm just like, okay, I can't do this anymore. It's just, my life is not going to accommodate war tax resistance right now. So I'm like, okay, I have to pay up. Well, what they'll do is, they're like, okay, you know, the fair and square, I owed them the $3,200. But the $10,000 penalty came as a result of me being a resistor. And so the War Tax Resistors Penalty Fund writes a note to everybody on their list and says, okay, this guy in Virginia just got levied $10,000. If everybody on this list threw in, you know, and they'll calculate it out, you know, if everybody threw in $21.32, then it'd be covered. And this, they do this. You know, they used to do it like three times a year or something, and these days nobody's been getting collected on, which is very odd. But yeah, and you know, they would always get more money in than they needed. So it's just this really inspirational mutual aid setup. I think if you look on the web, if you do a search on War Tax Resistors Penalty Fund. But yeah, that's an amazing mutual aid system where, you know, and it's also a way, I think somebody asked about how to support war tax resistors if you're not a war tax resistor. And, you know, like, we need that. You know, if you know, war tax resistance doesn't fit with everybody's lifestyle, and I think that's important. You know, it's like, for some people, it can be a really easy thing. And for some people, it may be a really difficult thing, and it may not be the way that you choose to register your dissent. But I think that supporting war tax resistors is a really important and necessary way that anybody can plug into war tax resistance. But phone taxes is one that I want to touch on a little bit. Phone taxes is one of those, and I think somebody asked about this too, like which taxes fund the military? You know, income taxes, basically all taxes go into this big pot, and then they kind of ladle out whatever goes to where. So basically any tax that you pay to the federal government is you know, half of it goes to the military, basically. But the phone tax is one of the, I think it's the tax, the only tax that we can really say this is specifically a war tax. It was instituted, I think, in 1898 when the U.S. was colonizing part of Mexico to pay for the war. And in Vietnam, it was supposed to phase out and it was specifically reauthorized to pay for the war in Vietnam. And there was a chance actually a couple years ago that as part of Bush's, this is a weird thing, as part of Bush's tax cut last year, we almost got rid of the phone tax, which would have been a really bizarre thing, you know, like this thing that all these war tax resistors have been fighting against, but of course it didn't happen. But so for a number of years, people have targeted that one and said, you know, specifically like, I'm not going to, you know, you just say I'm not going to pay this tax on my phone bill. Another thing that I want to talk about today is strategy. You know, we're talking about a specific tactic in an overall movement, and you know, how strategic is it? People were asking that, and it's a really good question. It's another thing to consider when you're talking about war tax resistance. But phone tax, especially in the Vietnam era, was this really amazingly brilliant strategic move. Because okay, so you get your phone bill, and say it's like $35 for a month, right? And of that, a dollar is tax. So you write a little note in there saying, I'm not paying the federal tax. And according to like the FCC, the Federal Communications precedent, the phone company just had to send a little note to the IRS saying, okay, this guy didn't pay his tax. So the IRS gets all these little notes saying, oh, here's a dollar here, 50 cents there, you know, $1.53. So for any one of those, it's just like, are they going to like stick this person who's being paid, you know, like $50,000 a year as like an auditor to like go chase that person down and get our $250 back, you know? And as I said recently, during the Vietnam era, between 200,000 and 500,000 people in the U.S. were resisting telephone taxes. And so it was not only a way to defund the government, it was also a way to stand up and for people like stand up in mass and do something very tangible. And it was also a way that the government really didn't have any good defense against. It just kind of, you know, grew, and it was a really good tactic. And it's been a really good tactic up until this year. And this year, the government finally basically changed the precedent with the FCC so that the phone company, basically if you don't pay your tax, then the phone company just starts charging it overdue balance. It's the phone company's responsibility now. And so telephone tax, I mean, we don't even know at this point with the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee kind of like what the upshot of it is, but at this point we're not advising people like we used to that telephone tax is a really easy way to start, because it may not be. I will say one thing, if you have working assets long distance, they will help you resist your telephone tax. If you do it 1 month and they send you these little slips every month that you just fill out with the amount of the tax and why you're resisting it, and you get to come with all these creative words and ideas, then you just sign it and send it back and they deduct it from your bill and let the IRS know. I don't know if they're still going to do that, but yeah.
Is that often for telephone
Yeah, I'm pretty sure like all phones have that tax. Cell phones, I don't think even ever they were under some sort of different law, so nobody was ever even able to resist taxes on cell phones, as far as I know.
One thing I've found works, at least with long distance, is if you simply don't have a long distance carrier, just use phone cards. There's no federal tax on that.
So let's just knock off the last couple of these really, really quickly. The one that I do, I'll just say, is independent contracting, and that's just kind of a fluke of the way I work. But I do website design, and so I get hired by some company, and I work as an independent contractor, which means I'm not on their staff. They pay me per project or whatever. So when I'm done, they just pay me a chunk of money, and it's up to me, supposedly, to be setting aside money and sending it into the IRS. Which you're supposed to do every quarter. And so, you know, that's again, like we were talking about the W-2 exemptions before, that's a way of transferring the authority and transferring the power from your employer to you so that you get to make that decision then. And so, you know, for me, being an independent contractor means I just hold on to the money, I actually stick it in an escrow account in a tax fund where the interest, like John was saying, the interest once a year we award interest from all the money that's in this fund to local organizations that are doing good work. Yeah, so then there's underground work. Obviously, if you're working under the table, nobody knows, including the government, that you're making money. So, you know, there's no paper trail, there's no tax due. And symbolic resistance is one that there's some folks that, when I lived in the Bay Area in California, there's some folks there who had been resistors in the Vietnam era. And then I've just noticed this phenomenon that you get older, you have kids, you may get married, you may buy a house. Life changes at some point, it seems, for a lot of these folks it did anyway, and suddenly it was just like it was not practical for them anymore to be war tax resistors and to kind of put all of this at risk. And so what they did is, there was this one really interesting campaign, and I think it's actually starting up again, where you send in your tax form and you pay everything except for $10.40, which is, you know, the 1040 form. So it's just this way of kind of symbolically saying, you know, I'm not going to pay, I don't agree with this, but you're not really putting yourself at much risk. You know, if you get like a dollar in interest, you know, and some like random little penalty or something, it's not a big deal. But it's again, kind of like the phone tax thing, it's a way to kind of have a bunch of little mosquitoes going in there and just being kind of pesky in little amounts. Yeah, I don't have that information, but there's a group.
It's called 1 Million.
Yes, thank you. Can you
talk about that?
I just saw a flyer for it or something at a different protest, but I think the webpage is like 1 Million flyers for peace or 1 Million taxpayers for peace or something.org.
Right.
I'm sure if you do like a Google search, it would come up. Though.
Right, 1 Million taxpayers for peace. Yeah, and the idea is for a million people in the U.S. to all decide they're not going to pay 1040 and then they'll all start doing it at the same time or something like that. Just kind of this mass action. So that's symbolic resistance. There's this kind of tension in the war tax resistance community, to be honest, between like anarchist tax resistors and war tax resistors and kind of what that means. And I gave you my take on that before of how I define war and how that kind of encompasses all the stuff that I see as systemically evil about our system. The way I think of it is there's these two strains within the war tax resistance movement. Henry David Thoreau marked this kind of transition in the movement that up until then, the history that I've read anyway of war tax resistance in the U.S. was mostly among peace churches like the Quakers and the Brethren and the Mennonites, that anytime a war came along, they were like, you know, we're religiously opposed to war. You know, we're not going there. And it would be a question for them of saying, I can't be personally complicit in this because it's part of my personal faith. And for me, the transition that Thoreau made was that he was trying, and in writing On the Duty of Civil Disobedience, he was pointing to a movement, a mass, a social change, basically. He was working for the social change rather than just kind of removing personal complicity. And I think today we still have, you know, both of those different strains going on, you know, different people analyze it in different ways. But for some folks, it can be a question of just feeling like, you know, I don't want to have my taxes paying for war. And I think that's what the Peace Tax Fund bill addresses. You know, if you have the choice of just of knowing that, okay, I'm giving money to the government and none of it's going to the military. It's not a question of what other people are doing, it's not a question of what the government's doing at large, but it's like, personally, I need not to be complicit in this, I need not to be doing this. And then I think the other take on it is, like I was saying before, this question of a larger societal transformation and what the part of tax resistance is in that. Well, do you have thoughts on that?
I'm not sure. I've been thinking about it.
What about if you believe in some of the things that the government does with federal money, like social services, public education, things that want to be able to support financially?
It's a tough question. I mean, you know, like I said, every war tax resister has their unique way of doing it, and you have to balance all these different things. You know, the amount of personal risk, balancing things that you want to fund versus things that you don't, the amount to which you want not to be, there's the term uncollectible, which means that you don't want the government to be able to take the money from you at any cost. You know, if that's your priority, if your priority is being really public about it and letting everybody know that you're doing this, you know, there's all these different axes, factors that you can balance against each other. But I'm interested in like following up on that, having a little discussion about that. And I think you had your hand up. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just going to say that even if you believe in the government, I mean, the essential foundings of the government was that we have the right to be participants in the government. And I think doing civil disobedience is a way of putting your voice in and having a say in the government. And I feel that too often the government is ignoring what we're saying, and they don't care. And that defeats the whole purpose of living in it. Well, technically, we're not in a true democracy, but we're pretty close. We're a republic, but you know.
There's a difference between agreeing with the idea of government and the idea of democracy, the idea of government, and agreeing with the specific policies that your government is taking on at that point. So, I mean, that's probably what people are doing when they're giving half their income tax. They're saying, you know, I don't want to support policies that I don't agree with, but I'm willing to support a society that takes care of each other. I mean, like, without our taxes, there are people who aren't being taken care of.
And like, how much of our taxes actually go to the welfare and stuff like that? I feel like most of it's not. And my question is, if you pay half your income taxes, what's stopping the government from taking that half and putting it in the war anyway?
It's a symbolic.
Well, yeah, I understand that, but
I think of answering that question of how do you participate in society and continue to oppose war, I think of Ammon Hennessy, Catholic anarchist, saying, you know, I didn't assign responsibility to other people to do the things that need to get done. I took responsibility myself. And from my perspective, I'd like to bring this back. I belong to an anarchist collective back home, trying to get an info shop going. And I see the potential opportunity for our community, like our collective, our neighborhood, and our larger community to take those resources out of the national level and redistribute them at a local level, taking responsibility for their own needs and desires and applying it in ways that even systems of public education and healthcare really don't assess because they're so bureaucratic.
Basically, yeah, we have the collection process. I mean, the worst case scenario, I think I'm about the best case scenario that I know of, just nothing happened so far. The worst case scenario is, you know, you don't pay your taxes, you get a note from the IRS, and they say, you know, either, you know, you filed a form, but you didn't include a check, or you didn't file a form, whatever. You owe us this amount of money. If you think that's wrong, let us know. And then they send you another form saying, okay, you know, you owe us this kind of money. Pay up. And then, you know, they give you a certain number of days, and they send you another letter saying, okay, well, if you don't pay up, then we're going to take it from you somehow. And so then they start this process of looking in your area. They look for bank accounts with your name on them at different banks. And they're at some point, they can go and, like, see if you have a house in your name, if you have a car. And then they have to give you notice. Okay, we found this bank. As far as I know, we found this bank account. It's got your name on it. It's got your social security number. And if you don't give us money within a certain number of days, we're going to take the money in that account. There's a lot of ways to do it. I mean, if you have joint property, it's your name's still on it, and still can still get seized. But some people, you know, like have their parents, like if they get a house, they have it in their parents' name, or they don't have a bank account. They have a bank account in somebody else's name.
For people who are like who still have family, when you know have family who care about who they care about, what are the ramifications for their family? Like, if I were to be a war tax resister and had my property or whatever in my parents' name, what would happen? What could happen to them?
As long as it's in their name and it's not in your name, then legally they own it. And if you're the one with the tax debt, you know, it's their house or whatever, their bank account. So, you know, legally there's not a connection there, so it can't be.
But if you don't have anything in your name, then you don't have any money, then you shouldn't be paying taxes in the first place. I mean, if everything of yours would be in someone else's name, then I guess it wouldn't really be a problem.
Taxes are always a question of income, of the amount of money that's coming in, rather than the amount of stuff you have, which is,
yeah,
we can get into if we want to pay.
I don't have a bank account because I don't want the government to know where my money is. And so my friend has a bank account or whatever. And so I make money and we put it in that account. They're going to be expected to pay taxes on that because they'll show up as them having income.
It's true.
They'll have an increase in the amount of money they have. and they'll be expected to pay taxes on them. And so they'll have to be tax resisters as well to avoid having that money that I made go to the government to kill people. Do you see what I'm saying?
You're saying that by dint of putting your money in a bank account, the government's going to say you've got income coming in. The people that own the bank account. But basically, it doesn't work that way. The government doesn't watch every bank account and say, oh, you've got income coming in. They're really only monitoring through reports from employers to the government. And if they were to open an investigation, they might start poking around and say, oh, you know, you've got all this money in here, explain that. But in general, it's not really a concern. It's not going to affect your ability to have a job, as far as I know, unless there's some sort of government job where they're going to do a big background check. You know, when they find out you're war tax resistant, they're going to find out other stuff. They're probably not going to hire you. But otherwise, no. There's a lot, and it's actually a popular, it's a kind of popular strategy that, you know, when people are working, you work, you get a letter from the government. The government's like, you owe us this money. We know you work here, and we're going to start garnishing your wages. It's called, which is they put a thing in so that every time you get a paycheck, you're employer has to give them most of the wages. There's a certain amount you're allowed. It's like $160 a week or something like that. And so what a lot of people do is quit that job and go find another one and just wait, you know, and it takes the IRS, you know, a year or years to track them down and then just do it again. So, yeah, there's no problem with just getting another job in that sense. And the credit report thing, I mean, theoretically, yeah, it pops up in your credit report, but I heard this amazing story once, which at a war tax resistance gathering in New England a couple years ago, this woman had been a resistor for a long time, had a big debt to the government. It was on her credit report. And she bought some, like, condo or co-op apartment in New York City. And they had her credit report sitting there, you know, and they're just looking at all this stuff. So basically, her credit report says she has a lien from the government for, like, $33,000 or something crazy like that. They didn't even bat an eye. Maybe didn't even notice it, or they didn't even look at it. And they just, you know, and she bought this place or sold this place or whatever it was. And so it seems like government lien is treated differently on your credit report than other sorts of things, but I don't really know. I would say call up Newtrick. Actually, if you go to the website, the phone number's on the website.
It's 1-800-269-7464.
They can answer most any question. And I'm happy to, you know, keep throwing stuff around today, but you know, anything that you're left wondering about at the end of today or that I didn't answer fully enough, call Mary. They've come up with a number of specific penalties. Like, I think the penalty for not filing is like $500. And there's interest, which is predicated somehow on the prime rate or something, which they just charge, you know, per day for every day that you haven't paid. I don't know what kind of penalties there are for phone taxes. And then there's other things, like some people during the Vietnam era would fill out a tax form and, you know, claim like 4 billion dependents, because they felt responsible for everybody on Earth. So they say, well, I don't owe any taxes, because I have 4 billion dependents. And so the government came up with this new regulation, which is the frivolous return penalty, which is some ungodly amount of money, like $1,500 or something, for every time you file a return that's got something that's obviously not in accordance to law like that. And but that worked for a while, too. That was another one of those creative little strategies people came up with then.
Okay, I have a question regarding, like, does this have any implications on things are there, like, state laws that you can't get a driver's license if you're not paying your federal taxes or something? You know, like, non-registrants for the draft, like, can't get driver's license or in some states, or, like, can't get financial aid, etc.
As far as I know, like, registering for the draft is, like, a cut-and-dry thing. Either you did or you didn't. And I think with taxes, the idea is you're just late. I mean, it's kind of like paying a credit card. It's not like you can't at some point ever, they can't ever decide you're not paying your credit card anymore. It's just like, you're really late with this payment. You owe us a lot of money. So as far as I know, there's no implications for that kind of stuff, because you're always theoretically there for them to get the money from. You were next, yeah.
Are there logistical differences of importance between filing and not filing?
Yes, there are. Yeah, those are, and again, that's one of those, another one of those places where you've got a couple different schools of thought. Yeah, you can either file, some people file a form every April and either say I'm paying half, I'm paying none, or, you know, whatever permutation they're comfortable with. A lot of folks will do that. It will type up a note, like, detailing exactly like, why they're not paying taxes and send in the form so that they're kind of registering how much money they do owe and the fact that they're not paying it. And then there's other folks who are just like, I'm out of here. I just don't want them to get the money, and I'm not filing.
That's what I do personally. I mean, I'm an independent contractor. They have, you know, very little way of tracking. I mean, they can track how much money I make, but they have very little control over kind of wrest that from my grasp. And so I don't. I decided a while ago just to not give them any extra help. But you know, the when people file every year, for some folks it's an important question of conscience and being upfront and being really public and not and making sure that they're not lying, they're not cheating, but that, you know, they're doing this thing and they're really clear about it. In my experience, those folks come from a really strong, often from a what's called a peace church. Again, the Mennonites, the Quakers, the Brethren, which are these churches that have these hundreds of years history of, you know, opposing war very solidly. And so you go to church on Sunday and you're with 100 other people who all feel the same way you do. And, you know, it's like, well, of course, you know, we're going to send in a letter and tell them we're not paying our taxes. And, you know, everybody around me in my community thinks the same thing, you know? And for me, yeah, I guess that's another, just for me, like not filing, it's a little bit easier because I don't have that huge extended community of people just like there bolstering me all the time. So sometimes it's a little bit scary. And so, you know, kind of stepping back a little bit.
I imagine that some people who would be critical of war tax resistance would say, oh, those people really just want the money for themselves. So how common is it for war tax resistors to actually direct that money to charities or things that they do believe in? And do you have any sense of how often people do that?
Did everybody hear that? He's asking, you know, that it would be easy to assume that war tax resistors just keep the money for ourselves. And he was wondering how often people actually redirect that money. I think everybody that I ever talked to about it who's a war tax resistor either puts the money in an escrow account, like in one of these funds that gives away interest, or just writes checks. And I put my money in an escrow account because I'm still scared that one day they're going to come knocking on my door and say, where's the $50,000 you owe us? And I'm going to be like... but, you know, I know a lot of people. There's one person in particular who's just like, you know, she just loves tax day because she sits down with her checkbook and gets to write, you know, $500 checks or $100 checks or whatever, all these organizations that are doing this amazing work, you know, like critical resistance, you know, organizing against the prison industrial complex and, you know, anti-racism training groups and just, you know, just really good stuff. So she just, you know, boldly goes out there year after year, and she's been doing it for decades, just giving the money away. Mm-hmm. You know, not giving it to the government, I'm giving it to you. Just, you know. So, you know, I don't, I mean, not that people would go around advertising it, but I don't know if people who are just keeping the money. And my sense is that they wouldn't find a real fitting home in the war tax resistance movement.
Sorry, I missed the earlier part of the talk. I was just arriving from out of Seattle. But I wanted to mention, sort of following up on that question, a new campaign that Seattle, Washington, and Portland, Oregon are doing that is trying to get people sort of to enter into tax resistance at a fairly low level. I have some flyers here if people are interested. We're calling it the Access of Peace campaign, and we're encouraging people to, instead of doing major income tax resistance, something more along the scale of phone taxes, to resist $9.11 or $91.11, to reclaim that and it's a redirection campaign. So what we're doing is we're actually asking people to send that amount of money in Seattle to our fund in Seattle, and we'll redistribute the money for you. And we'll also be collecting names so that we can make this very public, because our goal is to get like 500 people by this year, and then next year we'll try and do more. And we're doing it in Seattle, we're doing it in Portland. It's a pretty exciting campaign. And then, of course, people will withhold that amount of money then on tax day when they do it. So there's a website, actually, accessofpeace.info. The other thing that I actually wanted to mention, not so much because I want people to send stuff for redirection into local organizing, anti-war organizing in Seattle, which is where the money would go if you sent it to us, but because if you go to the website, all of our materials and stuff are there, and they should be pretty downloadable. They should be pretty easy to adapt to local place, you know, to just change and follow the model and use it in other cities. And the idea is to get a small amount by a lot of people, and then around tax day go really public with it.
So a couple people I know in the beginning during introductions asked about ways to convince other people, to talk to other people, arguments with other people for doing war tax resistance. So it sounds like that would be something you could adapt locally to kind of start a campaign in your community.
Yeah, and we
start
have support materials and stuff, Q&A, and to try and help people who are, I mean, we're trying to go sort of to the mainstream audience who pay a lot of taxes, a lot of them, and are scared of the IRS, and to sort of address their concerns, some of the things you're talking about. So we have some materials and stuff that are online. I have a few of them here with me.
Yeah, my question was not exactly the most honest question, but before someone over there had mentioned that if you only make like $8,000 a year, that you don't have to pay taxes. So if you were filling out your forms and you lie and you say that you make like less than $8,000 or $8,000 a year, what are the penalties of getting caught?
Well, when you earn money at a job, the employer reports your earnings to the IRS.
Yeah.
And so they can check.
Like even if you're like filling out like the W-2 form saying that like with 9 exemptions.
Well, okay, the W-2 form is only controlling how much money gets held out of your paycheck every week.
Yeah.
But
it's still saying how much you make.
The tax return is a totally different thing.
Okay.
At the end of it all in April.
So I'd have to work off the books and then lie on top
of
it.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
You know, I know some people like give guitar lessons at home or do massage or yoga instruction or something like that. And so they may earn whatever they earn to live on, and they report just under poverty level or just under minimum taxable level, because it's all off the books. But yeah, I mean, you can do it, but they can eventually catch up with you and say, oh, you underreported, so you owe us all this interest, basically. You had your hand up for a long time.
I'm just curious about if someone's war tax resisting and then they die, do their children take that up, or do their relatives, does IRS go to their family to get it?
As far as I understand things, and if other people are experiencing, correct me if I'm wrong, it's like this: it's an estate thing, just like anything else. If they're quick enough, they can kind of put a lien on your estate and take some of the stuff. But the IRS is not known for being very quick, in my experience. So, once the estate gets distributed out to the heirs, it's over and it's a closed. It's done with. But I don't know specific examples of that.
Are there any avenues for an employer to be a tax resister?
That's a good question. There is, I think, there are a couple, like the War Resisters League, which puts out this book. They refuse all IRS requests to levy the earnings of their employees who practice war tax resistance. Is that what you're asking about? Or are you asking
or just like any businesses that do that? But I would assume that it would just be
Pretty much going to be the kind of lefty kind of things like that. Churches. There's some churches that will do that too. But as far as like businesses refusing to pay business taxes and things like that, I haven't heard of it.
Yeah, I was wondering, where do you set up an escrow account?
There's actually a few kind of groups that have set up group accounts around the country. There's actually a number of them. There's one in Seattle, there's one in San Francisco, there's one in D.C. I don't even know how many there are, probably 15 or 20 at least, if not more. So it's not kind of an individual thing, it's more like a group thing where people kind of pool their money together. Somebody's kind of like watching it and keeping records of it, but it's out of the grasp of the IRS because it's not, the account isn't in your name, but yet the people running the account know that's your money. And then you can do things like the account that I have money in San Francisco every year on tax day. The money's like invested in like socially responsible investments, which is an entirely different conversation. But there's interest at the end of every year that we've earned off of that, and so we take that interest money and then take grant applications from local groups and then give away that interest. There's some groups where people just throw in their tax money every year, like I was talking about. My friend does before, and then just every year they just give away all this tax money that all these people have done. I think the DC group does something like that. Did you have something to add on that?
Well, I was going to say, if you wanted, I could give you the website for the Seattle one if people are interested in looking at, which is www.nacc.info.
Are there any groups that provide legal advice on these issues, like New Trick or
tax legal advice?
Yeah.
Like if you're getting in trouble with the IRS?
Yeah.
I think NutriC can hook you up with people. I know there's a couple lawyers that work with NutriC that kind of give advice. But I think a lot of the stuff that happens so often and it's pretty formulaic that you know, when you have a certain kind of letter, you call up the New Joke office, and they're like, oh, yeah, well, this is what's going to happen to them, this and this and this.
You've been listening to Sasha Vodnik of the National War Tax Resistance Committee speaking last January. You can find out more on war tax resistance by calling Newtrick's office at 800-269-7464. Thanks to George King for that tape, and to Scooter for the not-so-comic relief, and to Indie Media for assistance with this program. Our theme, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. You can reach us on the web at unwelcomeguests.org.